Welcome to EIR Talks. This week, we'll continue with our coverage of the conference held in May in Bad Schwalbach, Germany, of the Schiller Institute, which was keynoted by Lyndon LaRouche and Helga Zepp LaRouche. This show presents the second half of the science panel, held on May 5th. Following introductory remarks by Jeffrey Steinberg, we'll hear a presentation by Dr. Wolfgang Lilge of the Fusion Foundation in Germany.
I'm Jeff Steinberg. Welcome to the LaRouche Connection. I'd like to begin this week's show with some exciting news from Moscow. From June 27th to June 30th, 2001, Lyndon LaRouche, Helga Zepp LaRouche, and several other colleagues were in Moscow for a series of extraordinary public meetings. First, Mr. LaRouche, Mrs. LaRouche appeared along with Sergei Glazyev, the chairman of the Economics Commission of the Russian State Duma, and several other prominent Russian economists at a press conference at the National Press Center in Moscow. Over 50 journalists, 5 television crews, all participated in the press conference that went for more than 2 hours. In that event, Mr. LaRouche presented his vision for how Russia, under President Putin, can play a major role in steering the world through a period of grave economic and political crisis and help launch a new era of economic cooperation and progress centered around the development of what LaRouche has called the Eurasian Land Bridge, a series of development projects that would link continental Western Europe through Russia with Asia going into China, the Korean Peninsula, Southeast Asia, the Indian subcontinent, and the Near East. These ideas, LaRouche emphasized, hinge on Russia playing a vital role as a bridge between Western European civilization and civilizations of Asia. For after all, Russia is both a European power and a country that stretches across Eurasia to touch the very far northern corners of the Asia-Pacific region. And for that reason, both cultural and geographic, no real breakthrough development can occur in this part of the world without Russia being in the center of those developments. Now, Mr. LaRouche also reminded his audience in Moscow at the press conference that this concept of a Eurasian land bridge, which he developed beginning in 1988, has a long history in terms of the American system of political economy. During the 19th century, the crowning achievement of America's quest for a continental republic was the buildup of the Transcontinental Railroad, which was not merely a rail line, but was a series of development corridors, agro-industrial centers, water projects, and other kinds of great infrastructure projects that linked up the east coast of the United States to areas stretching all the way to the Pacific Ocean. And similarly, in the 19th century, Americans attempted to present those ideas as the model for the realization of Russia's development as a modern nation state and for the integration of the entire Eurasian continent. British geopolitical games prevented the realization of that plan, and instead of a Eurasian land bridge at the end of the 19th century, we got World War I. And so LaRouche was in Moscow to present the idea that those concepts, the Eurasian land bridge, this kind of tremendous prospect for economic development, is something that is the immediate mission for Russia under President Putin. After the press conference the following day, Mr. and Mrs. LaRouche appeared before a special session of the Economic Commission of the Russian State Duma, where they delivered testimony along the same lines that Mr. LaRouche laid out the previous day at the press conference. And again, LaRouche was joined in that event by a series of prominent Russian economists, including Glazyev himself, Sergei Glazyev, the young Russian economist who chairs the Economics Commission of the Duma, academician Lavov, and others. Now, the other major event that LaRouche was able to participate in during his visit to Moscow was a speech that he delivered before the Lebedev Institute, which is the Institute of Physics at the Russian Academy of Science, one of the great centers of Russian science and, frankly, one of the great centers of international basic scientific research. LaRouche delivered a presentation on the vital contributions of the late 19th and 20th century Russian scientist Vladimir Vernadsky. And in fact, LaRouche developed the fact that his own breakthroughs in science had come largely as the result of studying the work of Vernadsky, Riemann, Cantor, and others, and carrying forward Vernadsky's work to another level of fruition. Now, we'll have more to say in future issues of the LaRouche Connection about this outstanding trip to Moscow, but today we bring you an important event on a related subject, namely the work of Vernadsky. On May 6th, in the course of an international Schiller Institute symposium in Bad Schwalbach, Germany, a group of scientists, collaborators of LaRouche, delivered a series of presentations on the Vernadsky's contribution to world science. We now bring you excerpts of that extraordinary conference.
It has been the legacy of Vernadsky to the future world to continue the broad-based research effort begun by him to uncover the physical principles that are behind the differences between living and non-living processes. As we have heard in Jonathan's contribution, Vernadsky himself always has emphasized a universal approach to this problem. What is needed is an understanding of what are the physical characteristics of life that can be measured, among others, in terms of different types of radiation, different wavelengths, magnetobiology by biological criteria, the coupling between various living systems, between living and non-living systems, between living systems and astrophysical systems, also between non-living and astrophysical systems, and so forth and so on, all kinds of combinations. I want to report here about a number of biological technologies that have been developed completely outside the molecular biology mainstream in the last 30 years, which provide fascinating insights into the inner state of living cells. What has been established by those means is that cells have a specific kind of communication that is closely connected to extremely weak but biologically highly effective electromagnetic signals. By that, a new pathway of biophysical research has been opened, which focuses exactly on those key aspects of life that are systematically ignored by standard methods of molecular biology and genetics. In fact, the question, what is life, has been effectively removed from the established thinking in biology today. Molecular biology, which focuses exclusively on researching only the building blocks of nature, has completely lost sight of the characteristic differences between living and dead matter. For molecular biology, there is no qualitative difference between a living and a dead cell. Shortly before and after dying, a cell still contains the same molecules and structures. But what has happened in between? Where is the living force, or the animus vitae, as it was speculated about this question earlier? Before we elaborate more on the nature of those electromagnetic signals, which can also be called biophotons, we should look at some of the phenomenal achievements living processes are capable of. In growing tissue, it can be estimated that every single cell produces some million molecules per second, which is more by several magnitudes that can be what can be produced by laboratory means. There's another astounding figure. On average, every human being consists of approximately 10 trillion cells. This is the number 10 to the 13, which are generated by 43 successive rounds of cell doublings, like on the chessboard when you double one cell and so forth and so on. Only after this impressive precision work a human being will reach adulthood. However, at the same time, there's a constant turnover of cells coming and going. And every individual, every second, approximately 10 million cells die and must be replaced in a short period of time in order to prevent an entropic decay. It cannot be predicted where and when a cell will die, but if the replacement rate would only be slightly lower or higher, the body would disintegrate quickly. For example, if the growth rate of intestinal cells, which have a large turnover themselves, would exceed the cell death rate by only some percent, the body would rapidly die from obstruction of the intestines. The biophysicist Fritz Popp has pointed to the conditions which must be fulfilled that all these complex processes occur in a controlled way. There must be an intimate coupling of cell-to-cell communication, which, according to his calculation, can only be possible when the key control processes occur at the speed of light. Any other means of information transmission, including biomolecules, chemical messengers, etc., would not be sufficient. They would be too slow to guarantee the integrity of the organism. Already from this simple calculation follows the fact that light or electromagnetic action working with the speed of light in some form must be involved in the organization of living processes. The first systematic research into the role of light in living processes was done by the Russian scientist Alexander Gorovich, first slide please, in the 1920s, who was a contemporary of Vernadsky. He established a conclusive hypothesis that every living cell emits light, though a very weak one. His original experiment was very simple. Next one, please. He mounted an onion root in such a way that the tip of this first onion root pointed to the side of another onion root, but without direct contact. When the second onion root, after a certain time, was investigated under the microscope, it was shown that exactly at the point of affection, there was a significant increase of cell division, mitosis, compared to the opposite side. Maybe you can also take the next slide, where this process is more visible. So there, in this circle, you see the shaft of the second onion root. And at the right side, you see the amount of mitosis which have been added to the normal circumference of the onion root. This mitogenetic effect, as Gorovich termed it, continued to show when a small quartz window, which is specifically open for ultraviolet light, was inserted between the two onion roots. However, it disappeared when the quartz window was replaced by normal window glass or other material which is opaque for ultraviolet light. With several other experiments, Gorovich could definitely prove that the medium of this mitogenetic effect was in fact a very weak ultraviolet radiation emanating from the tip of the first onion root. And he calls this mitogenetic radiation. Subsequently, Gorovich and his collaborators developed methods to indirectly measure the intensity and spectral distribution of this mitogenetic radiation. This technique, together with Gorovich's other original contributions to biology, including his notion of the biological field, and the existence of a long-range effect between cells during the mitosis, became one of the main fields of biological research during the 1930s in the Soviet Union and elsewhere. However, increasingly, this approach to biology came under fierce attack by the proponents of genetics and molecular biology, which then after the war was made the dominant field of research. The major point of criticism from these circles was that the mitogenetic radiation didn't exist at all, or if it would exist, it had no biological relevance whatsoever. Actually, at Gorbachev's time, it was technically impossible to directly measure the weak light emissions from cells. This became possible only in the 1950s, when a group of Italian astronomers developed a very sensitive photomultiplier, which they used to make distant stars visible. When used on biological samples, it was shown that leaves, germs of wheat, corn, beans, etc., emit a constant but weak light. These results created some short uproar in the West, but was essentially forgotten again after that. Only in the early 1970s, this basic insight was taken up again when Fritz Popp, in his work on cancer research, found some very peculiar properties of a very strong carcinogenic substance. Just the upper picture now for the time. Okay. The substance to the left is called 3,4-benzpyrene, which is found in coal tar and in cigarette smoke. A chemically very similar substance to the right, 1,2-benzpyrene, is considered harmless in terms of cancer development. The only major difference between the two substances is that 3,4-benzpyrene has a strong absorption emission anomaly in the UV area of the spectrum. Pop asked himself, could these optical properties of the molecule be the direct cause of carcinogenicity, rather than any assumed chemical or molecular effect? That idea, of course, went directly against the established position of cancer research. In that context, Pop learned about Govich's work on mitogenetic radiation and concluded that if the assumed optical effect of benzpyrene was correct, then there must be some kind of light source inside the cell, and a very weak photon signal would be able to trigger drastic changes in the behavior of cells. Probably move that up a little bit now. So Pop and his collaborators started to construct a very sensitive light amplifier appropriate for measuring very weak photon emissions from cells. So this is only a diagram of this machine, where you see to the left the sample, and when the photons are emitted from that, they are just going through a filter and a chopper, and then into this photo multiplier where the single photon is simply amplified and made visible. It is a certain irony that Pop, after he had presented his ideas to leading cancer scientists in Germany, was first denied any research money because he said he wanted to fight light inside cells. For these people, a completely absurd idea. Only when he pledged to find out that there is no light in cells, he received some funds. With this machine, it was possible to prove beyond any doubt that low-level light emissions are a common property of all living cells. It has different intensities for plant or animal cells, for different cell types, and it can vary from one moment to the next. It is not regular, but comes often as photon explosions or spikes, as you see in this graph there, especially when the cell is irritated by outside means, by poison or other influences which change this kind of behavior. Much more interesting and telling for the role of biophotons in real life, however, were experiments which show the interrelation between two sets of living organisms. Probably move that up now a little bit. Just that the other one disappears, the whole thing should be seen there. Thanks, yeah. For this purpose, Pop developed a system with two independent photomultipliers and a mechanism by which the two samples under investigation could be optically separated from each other. So on the left one, there is a shutter is closed, and then the right one, it's open. Yes. So in the first round of experiments, he conducted with a creature called Goniaulax polyhedra, which is a tiny dinoflagellate. It's a kind of marine organism or something. The shutter was closed, and two completely different emission patterns resulted, which is the upper diagram. So the left is from the left photomultiplier, and the right one from the right. So there's basically a random kind of picture. However, when the shutter was opened and the two samples came into optical contact, the situation changed dramatically. What have been random events before became now a coordinated, tuned process of increased intensity, what you see. Simultaneous spikes of photon emissions occurred as if they had been agreed upon. In fact, one could draw an analogy to music and say that the disharmonic process turns harmonic. Actually, as Johannes Kepler perceived the relations of the planets as a musical harmony of spheres, we can also, in the case of biophotons, make this harmony hearable. Here's how Fritz Popp sets the electromagnetic communication between cells to music. Können Sie vielleicht das Tape jetzt vorbereiten, noch nicht gleich anstellen. Please do not expect these tones to be as beautiful as in last night's concert, but creatures as these dinoflagellates are not human after all. First we hear, now when the tape starts, the dissonance of the separated sample, so the upper curve, and then the harmony of interacting photon emission. You should know. Start the mal das tape. Now we can hear the first. Now, when the tape continues, we turn to the situation where the shutter is opened, and this kind of coordination is taking place. However, you should note that the tones you will hear do not correspond directly to the single photons emitted, but to the correlation of signals in both samples. So the higher the tone, the better the correlation. Okay, better. Well, I warned you, it's nothing compared to yesterday's concert, of course. All these findings point to a specific form of electromagnetic coupling, indicating a specific, specific kind of communication between living cells. Even if it is not known yet what the actual source of these photon emissions in cells is, and one should not fall into premature speculation on this point, they may even be outside astrophysical influences involved, but they have a definite biological effectiveness. And Popp has also shown that this weak radiation must have the quality of a laser, a multimodal, multi-frequency laser, to be effective. And that means this light must be coherent in space and time. Coming back to cancer research, probably the next, it is not surprising that the use of photon emission is able to show a clear distinction between healthy cells and cancer cells. This graph shows how normal liver cells, the lower curve, have a relatively stable or even falling level of photon counts at increasing cell density. So the bar to the right is the cell density, and the other axis is the photon count. While cancer cells of the same cell type show an increasing photon count at higher cell densities. It can be concluded from that populations of cancer cells have lost the harmony and coherence as it is typical for healthy tissue. I can only summarily report now about some impressive work by the Russian scientist Bolakov. It would need much longer elaboration to also show the direct consequences of this work for today. He provided a striking example of the superiority of the biophoton approach over the molecular dogma. The next slide, please. Bolakov brought samples of fertilized fish eggs in different phases of development in optical contact to each other and watched the Moutier effect. So you have two containers separated, and only in this filter area there you can put in various filters and windows which simply vary the effect which these contacts have on the samples. He reported the following results. Providing the age difference between the eggs were not too large, there was a significant acceleration in the development of the younger eggs relatively to the old ones. So if older eggs were in the upper one and somewhat younger ones in the lower one, the development relative to the normal development rate of these lower eggs were much faster.
You're listening to EIR Talks. We'll return in a moment with more of the May 5th science panel from the Schiller Institute conference. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the final portion of the speech by Dr. Wolfgang Lilge to the May 5th science panel of the Schiller Institute in Germany. Following that, we'll have Dino De Paoli, also of the Fusion Foundation.
However, if the age difference was larger, the younger eggs showed a strong retardation in development. Even deformities and higher rates of death occurred. This confirms, by the way, to observations in nature that fish normally avoid laying their eggs in sites where other eggs have already been deposited. Another result, when he used normal window glass as a filter in the middle there, all these effects disappeared, but the effects could be observed by use of quartz filters, confirming clearly Govich's earlier mitogenetic effect. Using filters for different wavelengths and polarizers, Bolakov even succeeded to create specific alterations intentionally and subsequently undo them again. In this way, monster larvae with multiple heads, multiple hearts, etc., were generated, but could be corrected by the appropriate use of other optical coupling effects. In fact, this latter case could be the beginning of an era of biophoton technology, as Bolakov himself stated, with a potential far bigger than today's biotechnology, which has a hard time to keep up with its far-flung promises. Obviously, in Bolakov's experiments, there had been no changes in the genome at all, whereas the biophoton action works on the level of the living process itself. At the end, we should include in the list of technologies for the investigation of the living process also the potential of magnetobiology. Research of this type has a long tradition, especially in Russia. For example, Chichevsky, and also in the 1950s and 60s, and recently also the Russian scientist Schnoll, made studies about the correlation between solar-induced changes in the Earth's magnetic field and the occurrence of physical events, for example, epidemics and so forth. Also, our friend Professor Brandimarte in Italy is a pioneer in this field since many years, and he has shown that oscillating magnetic fields of various forms can have striking effects on the healing of wounds and increase blood circulation. Last one. I hope this is somewhat visible. In this picture, you see on the left a very bad case of diabetes gangrene, so it's a leg which is already falling apart, basically, which would have been hopeless for traditional surgery. There's no circulation anymore in this area. But after the treatment with magnetic fields, the picture to the right, almost all the damages could be restored. In conclusion, it must be stated that we are only at the beginning of the era of life technology. Many more approaches, as the mitogenetic effects, the biophoton laser principle, and magnetobiology must be developed. The aim is to have methods which allow us to study all those multiple levels on which the characteristic action of life occur at the same time. Thank you.
So my team is what already Jonathan mentioned, the noosphere from Vernadsky. Now, Vernadsky developed this concept called noosphere, and he defined it in the following way. Under the action of a scientific thought and human labor, the biosphere goes over to a new state, to the noosphere. In this way, a never-ending growing set of new inert natural bodies and new great natural phenomena is created in the biosphere. This is not an occasional phenomena, but an elementary natural process whose roots are deep. So this is one, there are many definitions, but this is the best definition of noosphere, which I found it in Vernadsky, and is extremely fascinating. But in another occasion, can you put it a bit up? In another occasion, Vernadsky then expressed the following paradox, which he transmitted to us concerning the human thought. He wrote, as you can read, "Here a new riddle has arisen before us. Thought is not a form of energy. How then can it change material processes? That question has not yet been solved. As for the coming of the noosphere, we see around us at every step the empirical result of that incomprehensible process." So what is Vernadsky saying? Vernadsky recognized, obviously, the effect of human scientific discovery. He recognized its necessity and the naturalness. But he passed to us the riddle of the nature and the location of the human cognitive process. Some of the difficulty concerning the relation between energy and cognition derived both from a psychological and a methodological mistake. Too often, we get psychologically manipulated by the pleasure of trying to solve a virtual or false dilemma. For example, if someone would ask you, why that apple tree produce apples? I guess you would quickly realize that the question is fooling you. A more serious question could have been the following: why that apple tree did not produce apples this year? The same line of argument is valid if someone would ask you why that human being produced thoughts. In this case too, the real question should have been why the hell that idiot is not using his thinking. Thinking is for men as natural as apples. And in both cases, we have actually to worry only on how to improve the quality of the production. Methodologically, the paradox touches upon a more difficult area, which here, given the time, I cannot really develop except schematically. Vernadsky had hinted towards a Riemannian solution to the riddle of energy and thought. To account for the undeniable specificity and the geological role of living matter, he had stressed the importance to change our simplistic and abstract conception of one homogeneous infinite cosmos. Quote, a cosmos which might satisfy the geometer, but which contradicts the entire empirical knowledge of the naturalist. He pushed the posterity to elaborate instead the concept, quote, of the simultaneous manifestation of spaces characterized by different geometries in different domains. That is, the supposition of the geometrical inhomogeneity of reality in different cases and different manifestation of the cosmos. Different geometry may be manifested in phenomena under scientific study. Now, it's probably difficult to digest all at once, so you can think about it, but it's a very crucial statement from Vernadsky. This is obviously the core of the anti-monistic philosophy and revolutionary mathematics of Riemann, as far as Riemann himself adopted Leibniz's monadology. Riemann had developed the idea that in an inhomogeneous reality, we cannot linearly transpose the same type of measure from one domain to another without changes, but that nevertheless there is a discoverable principle, a curvature, which reveals the causal path that connects the different domains. In the next image I want to show you, can you put please, only the simplest expression of this phenomena, this Riemannian phenomena in nature, as I just said. I don't know if it's visible to you, yeah. This is a source of light which put from point A in a so-called, when it made to travel, in a so-called inhomogeneous media, as Vernadsky is talking about. In this case, it's water at different density of salt. We see that it's naturally curved. You see the bending of the light, which without developing, it's the same effect that the so-called gravitational field will have on the light. Now, when we move from light to the more complex inhomogeneous relation between matter, life, and cognition, or even inside each of such subdomains, we will not discover any more such simple and visible curvature. But the principle nevertheless remains that we cannot linearly transport measurements from one domain to another, although a causal functionality connects all of them. No matter the empirical evidences, there has always been an ideological attempt to ignore the above and to adopt a monistic, materialistic, or idealistic conception of one homogeneous, undifferentiated space, where human specificity, human free will, and human cognition either simply disappear in one of the subdomains or is moved to a virtual and arbitrary area of the so-called transcendental freedom of Kant, Fichte, and his followers. In specific, Vernadsky was obviously fighting, when he posed that paradox, against a so-called scientific argument, which is usually so formulated. Mind cannot be an efficient force of the physical world, otherwise the law of energy conservation would be false, and this is impossible. Now, here probably in the room there is some scientists and they are going to jump up. This is precisely where to put in question the so-called conservation law. So that's the main argument which Vernadsky was fighting. That's why he expressed what I quoted at the beginning. How can a non-physical force produce a physical change? A positivist, when he observes nature through his instruments, sees and measures only mechanical, chemical, and other forces, which form a closed totality. He does not see or measure any mental force. Therefore, according to him, a physically efficient mind cannot exist. One wonders, obviously, what kind of vegetables is there behind the microscope or the telescope observing mindless and objective nature. The opposition to Vernadsky obviously forgot that the law of energy conservation is a physical principle discovered by a human mind. Indeed, the appropriate and original formulation of this law is due to Leibniz and was derived from the idea that a sufficient reason is governing the universe. I cannot elaborate further on this issue here, but to help to locate and to find a place where to put cognition in the universe, I will use my favorite quotation from Pascal. Pascal wrote, "It is not in space that I must seek my dignity, but from the ordering of my thinkings. As space, the universe grasps me and swallows me like a point. By means of reason, I grasp the universe." Therefore, next time when a mathematician goes on the blackboard to prove to you that his own mind does not exist, accept it as a fact. But, as far as it concerns your own mind, try to adopt another method of proof. Now, this new method of proof could be called the great experiment of the conservation of existence. According to Vernadsky, the biosphere is characterized by a continuous transformation of biochemical energy whose real source is the sun and whose chief manifestation is the multiplication of living matter. Living matter can be studied then by linking its rate of reproduction to the efficiency of the energy transformation, and this measurable process was named by Vernadsky the durable colonization. Some of Vernadsky's ideas, associated with the work of Lotka and others, are today the standard way to study ecological system, but Vernadsky had stressed something which is avoided today. For example, if we could reduce Vernadsky in a scheme, in a very simplified scheme, we would see that Vernadsky, as Jonathan already mentioned, contrary to the neo-Darwinist, define a specific directionality in the evolution of the biosphere. The biosphere is like the light which I just saw express a curvature inside an inhomogeneous space-time. The directionality, and now, as you know, to introduce a directionality in the evolution, you are simply destroying or you make any neo-Darwinist to freak out. The dogma of Darwin is that there is no directionality in the universe in the evolution of the animals or the biosphere. So, as I said, Vernadsky, on the contrary, defined this directionality in the line L, where each stage, A, B, C, is characterized by a function, a quantifiable function, a measurable function, which today is called carrying capacity of the ecology. But none of the stages are absolute limits. Life finds the way through formation of new species to increase its rate of durable colonization. Such changes can therefore be ordered. One can discover a curvature also in such higher inhomogeneous and Riemannian spacetime. Sometimes Vernadsky adopts the hypothesis of the growth as a measurement of the growth and the perfection of the central nervous system. That is, he adopts the growth of the brain as a meter for ordering the increase in the power of the energy transformation. But let's see if this is really the case. If we shift from the biosphere now to the noosphere, we see that although man is a continuation to this natural trend of increase in free energy formation, it would be a major mistake to add man simply as another higher letter to the series along the line L, what we saw before. That is, man is not just an added inhomogeneity on top of the other species. The noosphere change, according to Vernadsky, changes the nature itself of the process. It operates in a different space-time and energy domain. Man's durable colonization of the Earth cannot be compared with any of the geometry characterizing one of the single species in biosphere. On the contrary, the noosphere becomes an enlarged mirror of the biosphere in its totality. Therefore, we can represent the noospheric or physical economy transformation with the same type of inhomogeneous space seen for the biosphere. We can see in this case the same that we have in the case of man. The curve obviously is not anymore a symbol increase. We know each time the civilization risks to collapse if it doesn't find the right indication. But we have in this case two symbol increase where each species now is a species of technology. So in other words, you have a totality of the biosphere is replicated in the noosphere. And it's not true that the noosphere is only one part of the biosphere. Now, to be concrete, we have evidence that at least since 2 million years, man was able to migrate all over Africa and Eurasia, and was therefore able to sustain durably his existence in very different environments. But I want to focus on a more recent example of such durable colonization, as Vernadsky called it, because it contains some interesting paradox. In this over idea, you see, is the title of an article which appeared in Scientific American last September. It reads, "Who were the first Americans? If your answer was fur-clad mammoth hunters, guess again. The first people to settle to the New World may have been fisher folk and basket weavers." What's the point of this debate? You know, and LaRouche has already mentioned it Friday, one of the main theses of LaRouche has been precise, that is maritime colonization, which defined the real evolution of men in the noosphere. Now let's look precisely at the next. The official accepted theory of the colonization of the American continent was still recently based on the so-called Bering Land Bridge theory. The idea was that mammoth hunters, following their prey and not knowing where they were going, crossed the land bridge between Siberia and North America approximately 13,000 years ago. When sea levels were much lower and the ice sheet had melted just enough to open the land passages through Canada, always following the animals, the hunters spread in 1,000 years through North and South America. That's the official theory. But the contradiction to this simplistic view of human beings as just following without knowing animals are beginning to force a change in the thinking. It's now accepted that 15,000 years ago there were already an established colony in Monteverde, Chile. in this area here. It's a 15,000 years old colony, which is momentarily the oldest known site of human habitation anywhere in the Americas. To this, it has also to be added the other puzzle of the presence of a probably 30,000 year old cave painting in Brazil, in Pedra Furada, Brazil. How could this be? How can we have in South America human colonization older than in North and older than the assumed date of a crossing of the Bering Bridge? Reluctantly, as shown here, the idea that the migration to America took place much earlier and therefore via sea is beginning to be accepted. There are two main eastern ways by which the migration probably took place, 40,000 years ago, followed later by others. The first route is the so-called Pacific Coastal Route. The possibility is that the migrants followed the coastlines in small boats, and the researchers are beginning to find the rest of prehistoric artifacts under the water along the American coasts. The other more interesting hypothesis, which has been accepted, is the so-called Pacific crossing theory. The same people which moved with boats in Australia and in the island in South Pacific for sure 50,000 years ago, and this is a fact, and possibly 100,000 years ago, might have continued traveling east, reaching other islands and finally South America, although there are still now only scarce evidence of this. There is also a possible western route, but this through the Atlantic, but this is not essential for the moment. Now, given the time, I have to leave to you to extrapolate all the implications of what I just said. But for sure, if the above is true, we have to accept that men had mastered some form of rudimentary astronomy long, long time ago. We can also easily imagine the role of the discoverer, his difficulty in convincing and educating his community. We can imagine the fear of many members of that society to recognize the necessity to sail towards the unknown islands. Therefore, such migration must have needed a transformation of the cultural space-time of an entire society. As Lino LaRouche wrote recently, the productive potential of the individual lies not entirely within himself, but in relationship of his development to the characteristic curvature of the society. Because of this, we can easily imagine that such migration were not accidental events or aimless adventure. They were conceived as necessary great missions whose success at the same time achieved and depended upon a permanent shift in the power of the society. From that time till today, we have largely increased the rate of survival of our permanent colony. We have therefore increased also the power of the biosphere to sustain life. But our brain has not increased 1 gram compared to the brain of those colonizers 40 or 100,000 years ago. Therefore, it's not anymore the increase in the brain size which can be used as indicator of the directionality of the evolution in the noosphere. Although a direction nevertheless exists, and it is coherent with the increased rate of permanent colonization indicated by Vernadsky and further elaborated by LaRouche. We have to shift metric. The engine that guarantees the self-conservation is not anymore a biological automatic process, although still a natural one. Because of this gained degree of freedom, we also risk at each generation to lose our right to govern the biosphere if we do not find the moral will and the spiritual resource to make discovery which uplift the society's ability to conserve the noosphere. The present Pope some time ago wrote the following passages. A good culture must be able to make man to overcome the fear of his own scientific discovery, the fear of the process of the transformation of the created to which he has been called by vocation. And the Church should never be tired to affirm the importance of man as man, of the fact that we have to love man because he's man, because his own singular dignity he possesses. As Vernadsky had correctly assessed, the biosphere is fundamentally dependent on the sun. We know that one day the sun will expand, causing an increase of temperature, which will kill the Earth biosphere. During that time, hopefully, we will have been able to establish a permanent colonization in Mars, and from there further towards the cooler outer planets, until we have again to face the unknown oceans towards the Americas located outside our planetary system. And in case you don't like traveling and want to remain here, we will have to study deep our sun, repair it, so that it can run a bit longer. Thank you.
Anyone interested in further pursuing the work of Vladimir Vernadsky should know that the winter 2000 to 2001 issue of 21st Century Science and Technology contained some of the first English translations of some of Vernadsky's writings. So this has been a very special edition of the LaRouche Connection, perhaps a bit far afield from our normal agenda of international political developments, but one that I believe probably all of you found most significant and hopefully worthwhile. This is Jeff Steinberg signing off for the LaRouche Connection.
You've been listening to EIR Talks with excerpts from the Schiller Institute Conference on May 5th, the Science Panel. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.